Well, good morning. Certainly appreciate all the efforts of the choir and everybody else that has done so much to make this feast a success. As we begin this message today, I'd like you to take just a moment to think about what it is going to be like when we are in the reality of what this feast pictures. We will have been changed. No longer physical beings, but spirit beings, members of the God family, ruling with Jesus Christ, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But what exactly will we be doing? As priests of God, we will be working with people. People who know nothing about the plan of God. We are going to have to teach them how to live, how to act, how to love, how to be. Think about what it's going to be like for them, especially at the beginning. They will have just experienced the most devastating period of time in human history. Man will have been at the brink of annihilation. They will have been fighting against God and didn't even know it. And here they are, alive somehow. What are they going to need? Well, I think they're going to need some reassurance that the worst is over, that the enemy has been removed, and that peace can reign. They'll need to understand how we got there and what the future will hold. They will need to know who and what God is, who and what man is, and why he was created. They will need to know and understand what God's plan is and all about it. As priests of God, those are the things that we'll need to teach them. Right? Priests are to teach the people about God and about God's way of life. Today, we're going to explore what it might be like during the millennium. Now, I think we all understand that at the beginning, the world is going to be a mess. The wars, famine, pestilence, not to mention God's wrath that follows, will be devastating. And it will be our responsibility to help those who are living at that time to understand it all. And I'm sure that it will take some time before people are able to move forward. Not only with rebuilding their lives, but also a society under this new government. How long that will take, I have no idea. Now, I would say that we don't often think about these things so much during the feast. We tend to focus on all the good things that will be the result. Things like what we read about in Isaiah chapter 11. We read the first five verses a few minutes ago, but let's turn there. We're going to read the next few verses. These are things that we generally hear at least once or twice during the feast. Isaiah 11, verses 6 through 9. Isaiah 11, verses 6 through 9. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. What a beautiful picture that is. And we have focused on that picture so much that, well, probably for most of you here, you'll remember that the seal of our church used to picture that very scene. Take a look at a few more millennial passages that we turn to quite often during the Feast of Tabernacles. Turn back a few pages to Isaiah chapter 2. We're going to read verses 2 and 3 here. Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. We sang a song with those very words yesterday. And again, it sounds wonderful. And it will be. But I do want you to notice something here. Let's take a little closer look at what verse 3 says. Isaiah 2, verse 3 begins, many people shall come and say. It does not say all. Many people. The implication being that some will not come. Things are not always going to be perfect. Go toward the back of the book of Isaiah next, Isaiah chapter 30. We were at the feast in Gatlinburg last year, and Greg Thomas gave a message where he touched on the sacrifices that are to be made during the Feast of Tabernacles. These are found in Numbers chapter 29. And he pointed out that there will be a total of 70 sacrifices altogether. On the first day, it begins with 13 bulls, and each day the number of bulls decreases, and on the seventh day, there were only 7 bulls sacrificed. The implication being that overall, sin would decrease as time moves on. But that would also indicate that things are not perfect, especially at the beginning of the morning. So Isaiah chapter 30, we're going to read verses 19 through 21. Isaiah 30, 19 to 21. For the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. You shall weep no more. He will be very gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears it, he will answer you. And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore, but your eyes shall see your teachers. Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way. Walk in it whenever you turn to the right hand or whenever you turn to the left. And I think this shows a couple of things. One is it shows our role to a certain extent in action. We will be those teachers. We will be there to help them, to see when they are going astray. And it also shows us part of God's role in helping to ensure that they are learning and growing. They will be tested. And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. Now, all of us are being tested today, aren't we? And we should understand that there will also be tests in the future, including those who will be living during the millennium. Let's look at one more passage in this regard. Zechariah chapter 14, verses 16 through 19. Another very familiar millennial passage. Zechariah chapter 14, verses 16 through 19. And here we read, and it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. I know we have read all of these things before. And I think for the most part, we assume that all of this must be at the beginning of the millennium before people understand what it's going to be like. After all, Jesus Christ will be the King of Kings. He will bring peace and prosperity to the whole world. Everything will be restored to the way that God intended it to be. The whole world will be like the Garden of Eden before Adam and Eve made that terrible decision to decide for themselves what was right and what was wrong. But is that an accurate picture? Is that a complete picture? Is there anywhere in the Bible that we can go to and see if this might be true? Is there anywhere in the Bible where God was king and gave people everything that they could ever need? Is there anywhere that we can go to see then what the millennium might be like? I think there is. When the children of Israel left Egypt, who was leading them? Now, I suppose you could say Moses, but was he really? I think everyone knew that Moses was really only doing what God told him to do. But let's turn to Exodus chapter 13. There's something written here at the beginning of their journey that I think is important to understand. So Exodus 13, verses 17 through 22. Says, then it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. And then down in verse 21, it says, and the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of flower. That would be really an interesting one, wouldn't it? So how about the pillar of fire? By night, from before the people. God was everything to them. He was their king, their protector, their guide. And he had performed miracle after miracle, getting them to this point. And they could not deny that God was the one who was watching over them and protecting them. Let's turn over a few pages to Exodus chapter 15. So how did things go after this? Well, I think you all know the story, but we're going to review a few things. God led them out of Egypt. He led them through the sea. He destroyed the Egyptian army. And here we are now in the middle of Exodus chapter 15, beginning in verse 22. So Exodus 15, verses 22 through 27. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Now, when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah because they were bitter. Verse 24, and the people complained against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters were made sweet. There he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them and said, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the disease on you which I have brought on the Egyptians. For I am the Lord who heals you. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees. So they camped there by the water. So God took care of them. The water that they couldn't drink, God fixed it, allowed them to quench their thirst. And he told them, obey my ways. Do what I tell you to do, and I will take care of you. And I will protect you. It says he tested them. And we do see, as we read through the rest of the story, that they were tested over and over again. And I think we can expect to see that there will be tests along the way throughout the thousand-year reign. Go to Exodus chapter 16 now, verses 1 through 3. And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. So just a month since they left. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the fill, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and ate our bread to the full. Life must have been great as slaves in Egypt. Now, it certainly seems to us to be an odd perspective, doesn't it? It goes on to say, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. God provided manna for the next 40 years. They ate bread that God sent them every day until they reached the promised land. Exodus 17, again beginning in verse 1, verses 1 through 6. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Another test. Will you trust me? Will you believe that I can care for you? Verse 2, therefore the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink. Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So again, they were thirsty. They complained, but God provided for them. Bad water, God fixes it. No food, God rains food from heaven. No water, God brings water out of a rock. Later in this chapter, the Amalekites attack, and God protects them in a way that there was no doubt that it was God who protected them from, or from the Amalekites. And then they come to Sinai. Right? God makes a covenant with them. If they will obey him, he will take care of them. And he has proven over and over that he can do that in every way. And so they agree. And God gives them laws and instructions to live by. All in all, the children of Israel spend about a year and a half at Mount Sinai. We're not going to look at every instance where there were problems, but let's summarize a few things. After leaving, or shortly after leaving Sinai, the people complain about the manna. Yes, you're feeding us, but we're tired of this. We want some meat. And God provides them with quail. This leads to more problems because they didn't handle that properly, did they? And then Moses himself complains because he's overworked. And so God tells him to choose 70 elders to help him. And this also leads to some other problems because, well, let's face it, not everybody was as righteous and faithful and humble as Moses was. And then Aaron and Miriam complain about Moses. And Miriam ends up with leprosy for a time. And then they come to Kadesh Barnea to cross the river into the promised land for the first time. And they decide to send out some spies to see what it's like. Now, at this point, we're about 2 years into their journey. They have seen everything that God has done. Every day they see this pillar of cloud and pillar of fire. Every day they eat food that God provides for them. He destroyed the Egyptians. He protected them from the Amalekites. He provided water. He provided food. He took care of their every need. And when the spies come back and tell them what a wonderful land it is, but there are these giants there and we can't defeat them. What do they do? Well, they complain and don't trust that God can take care of them. So God tells them that now they're going to wander in the wilderness for the next 40 years until all of those of an age of responsibility will die off, and their children, who they said were going to die, would be allowed to enter into the promised land. We're going to pause here for a moment and look at how all of this might equate with the millennium. Start by doing a few calculations. And if the 40 years in the wilderness equate to 1,000 years of the rule under Jesus Christ, that means that each year of wandering is about 25 years. At this point, we're 2 years in, which equates to about 50 years into the millennium. And I would say that's still relatively new. See, those things that we talked about earlier would still seem to be applicable. People are still learning to trust God. It takes time to overcome our past. How long have you been in the church? And how perfect are you? If we look forward to the next 36 to 38 years, there are not a lot of details. And I'm talking about the children of Israel wandering. Well, we don't know what the next 36 to 38 years in our life will be either. But for them, there's not a lot of details. Sporadically, we see that there are some problems. But for the most part, it seems relatively calm. Now, there is a man who was stoned for working on the Sabbath. Korah and his cronies rebelled, and God dealt with them. The Levites complained because Aaron and his sons were the special ones, and they wanted a part of that. And so God clearly showed that he had chosen Aaron and his family. So there are problems that are ongoing. And I think that would equate, again, to what we read in Isaiah 30. Go back there and read that passage again, Isaiah 30, verses 20 and 21. Then we are told, "And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction," those tests that we read about that the Israelites went through, this is very consistent with that. Bread equating to hunger and water equating to thirst. Then it goes on to say, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore, but your eyes shall see your teachers. They will know us, and we will know them. Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it, whenever you turn to the right hand or whenever you turn to the left. We will be there. And we're going to be teaching them and helping them. We're going to help them and show them the right way to go. You might be wondering, though, if Satan is put away and God's Spirit has been poured out, why will there still be sin? So, I guess I have to ask another question. Think about your life. Can you honestly say that the only reason that you sin is because of Satan? Certainly not. I know I can't. I'd like you to consider what James has to say on this subject. James chapter 1. We're going to read a couple of verses there, verses 12 through 15. And James is one of those guys that, well, he's not very fluffy, is he? He just comes out and tells you like it is. James, chapter 1, verse 12. Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone, but each one of us, you could say, is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. And I say, hate to say it, but that's absolutely true in my life. And I'm pretty sure it's true in your life as well. Verse 15, then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. That's what we're trying to prevent. And this isn't the way we want to live our lives anymore. And like we should be doing, we would hope that the people will grow over time and sin less. But the reality is that we all still sin, and so will they. Go back to the Israelites again. They are still wandering in the wilderness. My title, by the way, is Wandering Through the Millennium. And we're going to pick up the story in Numbers chapter 20. And this is close to the end of the time of their wandering in the wilderness. In verse 1, we read about Miriam's death. In verse 2, we read that once again, there is no water. And the people complain. And so here we are after nearly 40 years of God taking care of them, providing their every need. Every day they get manna from heaven. Every day they see the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire that is leading them for 40 years. I love this part. For 40 years, their feet don't swell or hurt. Is there anybody in the room that can say that anymore? Their shoes don't wear out. Numbers 20, beginning in verse 2. Verses 2 through 12. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron, and the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, "If only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. Why have you brought us up, or brought up the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness, that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink. 40 years of God's protection. 40 years of God's miracle. And yet they still do not believe that he will take care of them. Verse 6. So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and they fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron gather the congregation together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock, and give drink to the congregation and their animals." So as he had done so many other times, God tells Moses what he should do and what he should say. Right? Take your rod and Aaron and speak to the rock. Verse 9, so Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. And he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Here we are after 40 years. And even Moses makes a mistake. He does not fulfill his responsibilities as he is supposed to. He let his anger get in the way of doing what God told him to do. Verse 12, then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Moses made it that close. It didn't make it into the promised land because of his sin. In the next chapter, we again see the children of Israel complaining. They spoke against God and Moses, and so God sent serpents to bite the people, and many died. When the people came to Moses and acknowledged their sin and asked him to pray to God, he did so. And God provided them with a means to survive. But they had to do what he said. They're still being taught to trust God, to believe. There's one more thing that I want to look at that takes place towards the end of their wandering in the wilderness. The story begins in Numbers chapter 22, but we're going to skip to the end, which is found in Numbers 25. Now, this is the story of King Balaam, and the Midianites. The Midianites were afraid of the children of Israel, and so their king, Balak, asked Balaam to come and curse the children of Israel. However, God would not let Balaam do that. And so instead, he blesses the children of Israel. Of course, Balak was not happy, and it appears that Balaam really wanted to do it because, right, he was going to be given a lot of money At the end of chapter 24, we see that Balaam and Balak part ways and head home. However, there seems to be more to the story. And we find that in Micah chapter 6 and 2 Peter chapter 2. We're not going to look at those, but you might want to look at them sometime. And we learn that while Balaam does not curse the children of Israel, he does tell Balak what to do to cause God's anger to come upon them. So we'll pick it up here in chapter 25, verse 1. Numbers 25, verses 1 through 3. Now Israel remained in acacia groves, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. So here we are at the end of 40 years at once. 40 years of God watching over them and protecting them. 40 years of miracles, manna, water, the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire, and so much more. And now they turn their back on God and bow down to other gods. Now, I should note that not everybody did that. Not everyone sinned. Not everyone bowed down to other gods and turned away from the real God. However, this rebellion is put down quickly and forcefully. We read a little bit about that in the next few verses, Numbers 25, verses 4 through 9. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." So Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Every one of you, kill his men who were joined to Baal of Peor." And indeed, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her body. So the plague was stopped among the children of Israel, and those who died in the plague were 24,000. That is not an insignificant number. And there may have been more who sinned. It just gives us the number that died. Now, at the beginning of the message, I said that I wanted to talk about what life in the millennium was going to be like. Will it be paradise? Will it be filled with righteousness, peace, and prosperity? On balance, I would say yes, for the most part. However, it is not going to be perfect. If we consider what it was like for the children of Israel after leaving Israel, after leaving Egypt, I think we get a glimpse of what it might be like to a certain extent in the millennium. It might be rough at the beginning. People will be devastated. They will need to learn how God's ways work. They will need to repent and change from the way that they had lived. And it will take time. Change is not easy, is it? It's hard. Some of us, as I mentioned, have been around for a long time, maybe 50 years or more. And we still struggle at times, don't we? Even with God's Spirit, we struggle. they have help. Right? Jesus Christ will be king. He will rule with righteousness. We'll be there to help. And we will help them through the difficult times. We will teach them about God. We will teach them about His ways. We'll teach them the truth. And we will point out what is right, the right direction when they stray. But they will stray just as we stray. It's not going to be perfect, especially at the beginning. But we would hope and we would expect that things are going to get better, much, much better. And we read about how much better it will be than this. But what about what we just read about the end of the 40 years of wandering? 40 years of God taking care of Israel. What about that rebellion at the end? Will we see anything like that? I'd like you to turn to Revelation chapter 20. Now, in this chapter, we do see a glimpse of that time and how wonderful it will be. Right? The 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ, when Satan will be put away, and we will be there as kings and priests with Jesus Christ as our king. Let's drop down to verse 7 and read what is described there. Revelation 20, verses 7 through 9. It says, now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. Fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Yes, at the end of the millennium, there will be a rebellion. It's hard to believe that such a thing will happen, but it will. And it says the number of those who rebel is as the sand of the sea. This will not be a small, insignificant rebellion. And like the one we read about at Acacia Grove, this one too will be put down quickly and forcefully in the now. Why is all of this important for us to consider and understand? I think first and foremost is so that we won't be disappointed. If we head into something and we expect it to be perfect and it's not, right, when reality doesn't match our expectations, it's easy become discouraged. And I don't want you to be discouraged. Think about what you feel like when what you pray for does not happen the way that you want it to. And I think we've all experienced that, haven't we? Does that mean that God's not with us? That God doesn't love us? That God doesn't protect us? But we question, why doesn't God answer me? See, when we're disappointed and discouraged by something like that, it's difficult for us to do what we're supposed to do. Put all of our trust and our faith and our hope in God. And we have a job to do. So that's the second reason, because I want all of you to do the very best job that we can possibly do. We will be working with people for 1,000 years. Priests of God, teaching them about God and about His plan, helping them to understand how to live, how to love, how to be. That's the job that we will have to do in the morning. What will it feel like if the people that you've been working with all of their lives join that rebellion at the end? See, we will have used everything in our power, everything that we can possibly do to help them to understand. We know what it's like to live in this world under Satan's control. And we will know the difference of what it will be like to live with God in control and Jesus Christ as our King of Kings. We know His ways, and we know Satan's ways. We understand the difference, and we'll need to explain all of that to everyone who lives throughout the morning, so that they too can be prepared and understand what is coming, reject Satan. Christ. I think we're going to use our own examples. There are probably things that you have never told anyone else about yourself. But maybe that's the thing that will help somebody. Maybe that's what we need to talk to them about, to help them to be prepared, to explain how we finally overcame with God's help. And we'll be there to help them. We're told that we are the weak of the world, and yet we will be there. And we will know what it's like for them. And that's the last part of it. We need to be prepared for what's ahead. Everything we do today is not just to get there, but to prepare us to do God's work when we are there. That's what this is all about. God wants everybody to be in His family, and it's our job to help Him, to get everybody we possibly can to be there, to help them get there too. And so we need to be prepared. Brethren, I hope you have a wonderful, profitable feast. And may you all be prepared for whatever.